Science fiction is full of stories about the quest for longer life. We had a recent guest who told us it's all a fantasy, that basically we're living as long as we are going to.
We have become so successful in extending life, in allowing people to live out past 60, 70, 80, even 90, that the majority of the population is going to be exposed to the basic biological process of aging, which is immutable currently. And so if you expose enough people to this immutable force, the gain in life expectancy must slow down. So this slowdown in the rate of improvement is not a consequence of harmful behavioral risk factors. It's a consequence of success, of living long enough to experience something that is currently immutable, which is the aging process. So this is what we expected about 30 years ago. It's exactly what happened.
Well, Jay, I want to sort of level set our conversation, which I think is such a fascinating one. So one, I want you to share with our listeners, what is life expectancy right now in the United States and how does it compare to others? But part B of that would be almost everything that I've been reading has talked about the deaths of despair and how the deaths of despair is what is really driving this. And I wonder, I know this is going a couple of levels into this, but is that segregated by social factors and disparities factors? And are you kind of separating those things out? So take that, start that wherever you like. Thanks. Yeah. I know it's a few questions in one.
Lots of questions in there. So let me explain what life expectancy is, because I think a lot of people don't really understand what it is. So for a baby born today, right, how do you figure out how long that baby's going to live? So the way in which this is done is that we use something called a life table. It's nothing more than an accumulation of all the death rates that exist today for people at all ages. And we assume those remain constant. And under those conditions, we can calculate how long an average baby today would live. This is not the same as the prevalence of the older population, which will rise pretty dramatically during the course of the 20th century due to past trends in birth rates. So right now in the United States, life expectancy is about 80. It's a little higher for women, a little lower for men. Where are we relative to the rest of the world? I think we're maybe somewhere around 45. The vast majority of other developed countries has a higher life expectancy. Now don't get me wrong, they're pretty close to each other, but there are some life expectancies up in the mid 80s for females, like in Japan or Hong Kong, for example. The United States, we're several years behind.
We got started because of an observation that our medical system is essentially built to chase horses after they've already left the barn, and horses are very fast. So instead of horses, think cancer, heart disease, stroke, and so forth. Well, keep them in the barn in the first place is a good idea. And so prevention, pre-action, if I can coin a word, is the way to proceed to deal with most of these.
David Goebel is the co-founder and CEO of the Methuselah Fund, and Danielle Ruiz is a fellow with the fund. They'll explain their pathfinding strategies and how they're challenging conventional thinking about aging and human health.
Our focus is more about health span versus longevity in exclusion. We're not just focused on living to, 150 or 300, but ill. Most people currently who live past 60 or 70 years of age are dealing with chronic conditions that limit their productivity and their joy of life.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, welcome, David and Danielle, to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, let's just start with David. You know, the Methuselah Fund believes that more is better, and your mission is to make the age of 90 the new 50. It sounds good at the end of this year. But maybe you could explain to our listeners the mission in detail and how you're going to go about it.
Sure. So officially, it's make 90 the new 50 by the year 2030. So we have a little bit of runway ahead of us. and so we got started because of an observation that our medical system is essentially built to chase horses after they've already left the barn. And horses are very fast. So instead of horses, think cancer, heart disease, stroke, and so forth. Well, keep them in the barn in the first place is a good idea. And so prevention, pre-action, if I can coin a word, is the way to proceed to deal with most of these. So that's not a radical idea. Lots of people have it. But the reason that we're going after aging is that's where the barn begins to break down and the doors fly open. And so we want to shut the doors by delaying, preventing, reversing aging, then the diseases typically just don't happen. So that's the Methuselah Foundation. The fund is our subsidiary, which is closed right now, that was used in order to create a model commercial portfolio of advanced ideas that turn into companies for reversing aging, reverse aging technologies. And it was designed for that purpose and also for other investors to look at it and borrow, beg, and steal from the ideas. Because we're a nonprofit. We want people to steal our ideas if they're good.
Well, David, you and your supporters are very focused on maximizing what you call return on mission. And I would say, I think you have the attention of our listeners just with your 90 is the new 50. So a lot of interest, obviously, in this. But, you know, return on mission, that wording is very interesting. Clearly, you're driven towards an end. But you're right about the need for new parts for people and getting the crud out. So given that you have all of our attention, how does that all happen? How do you manifest the work on that mission?
Well, we make grants to other longevity positive nonprofits. We have started, I think, 5 other nonprofits and let them spin out and do their own thing. We have co-founded financially and by sponsorship, I think it's 12 companies now. And we have sponsored 3 prize competitions because prizes are an extremely powerful amplifier of progress. And the only thing that the sponsor of the prize doesn't get is any money or any fame. Nobody remembers the fellow who was instrumental in the creation of the polio virus vaccine. His name was Basil O'Connor, personal friend of Roosevelt. Everybody remembers the Salk vaccine. But without Basil O'Connor, that would never have come about.
Danielle, let's get into the weeds a little. You're a fellow with the initiative, and you co-developed the Methuselah Protocol, which is the first formalized longevity protocol. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about how this is being delivered to patients, and also just maybe a broader sense of the details.
Absolutely. So the Methuselah Protocol that we developed in partnership with the Methuselah Foundation is essentially a body of measures and interventions that are evidence-based to be safe and effective in humans to extend the years of generally healthy life. So our focus is more about health span versus longevity in exclusion. We're not just focused on living to, you know, 150 or 300, but ill. Most people currently who live past 60 or 70 years of age are dealing with chronic conditions that limit their productivity and their joy of life. So we're focused with our protocol on extending those healthy years of life. That's being delivered at Everest Health, which is our medical practice here in Vienna, Virginia. And we do a variety of approaches to make this protocol, this body of measures and interventions, very effective for each individual person. So it's personalized in nature, meaning that you are not a statistic. Every individual, even in a snapshot of time, we're different in summer versus winter. Of course, men are very different from women. different age groups, different disease states, different family history. We need to approach all of that in a different way to get those good results. We also take an integrative functional medicine approach, meaning we're not focused simply on symptoms or diseases. We're focused on the root cause, the underlying drivers of the aging process. And we're also focused on the whole person. So that includes physical, emotional, cognitive, social, environmental factors. All of those things we see in the research are contributing to people who are able to age or stay young successfully versus experiencing premature diseases of aging. Of course, the partnership with the Methuselah Foundation allows us to maintain that cutting edge approach, meaning we incorporate whatever is evidence-based to be safe and effective in humans, the newest research. So with conventional medicine, the evidence shows that it takes about 17 years for what is proven to become a part of the body of interventions, and then between 5 and infinite years for medical practitioners to begin to apply it and make it accessible to patients. So that's unreasonable. We want to make sure that when something is proven to be beneficial, we provide it to every patient in a clinical setting. And so that is also a large aspect of our approach, that as we see in the research, there are measurable qualitative and quantitative things that we can do and can measure to positively manipulate and delay or regress diseases of aging, that we're also holding ourselves accountable to the scientific rigor of being able to measure those outcomes for our patients.
Do you mind if I jump in for just a second?
Sure, absolutely.
Sure, I'm a patient. I was patient zero when I hit 68 years of age. I had a near stroke event where I woke up one morning blind in my left eye. And then about 3 weeks later, I woke up and was reading my devotional in the morning and noticed that I couldn't put a sentence together. I could read the words, but not put a sentence. And I thought, you know, it would be very embarrassing to be a co-founder of a longevity nonprofit and just like die. That would be, you know, embarrassing. So that's when Danielle and I began working on a protocol, as it were, to eat our own dog food. Mm-hmm. And over the course of 6 months of the, call it an experiment, my blood pressure went down from 169 over 93 to 120 over 73. And most interestingly, I was heading toward glaucoma. My intraocular pressure reduced 25%. That doesn't happen, and yet it did, because of the hyperbaric oxygen therapy, which I guess for several years was considered to be kind of snake oil, but there's been excellent research done in Israel that shows it's extremely effective for a lot of things.
Great. Well, let me maybe stop you there and say that's you've put out one thing right now that is not general, conventional part of practice. Everything else, and Danielle, I loved your description of the practice. Everything else is what I would call describing really good holistic primary care, complete with the cognitive assessments and what Medicare has deemed the Medicare annual wellness visit, the screening for social isolation, cognitive problems, et cetera, focus on nutrition, healthy lifestyle, active and fit. So I guess I'm curious. And of course, the 60 minutes with your patient is a huge value and contribution. And maybe we ought to be looking at that independently as a variable, because certainly all primary care people would love to have that much time. And maybe we could prove that there's a change in mortality or morbidity because of it. But I'm really curious, how much do you both assess as you are doing what the science has already told us in terms of screening, risk assessment, nutrition, diet, exercise, social connection, and where are the interventions that maybe that you're describing as having a strong evidence base, but may not yet have been accepted because of this, you know, the what they call the 16-year lag from bench to the exam room. I hear the hyperbaric oxygen. Is there a sort of group of interventions that you really think are unique to the work that you're doing? I think our audience would love to hear more about that.
Absolutely. So, yes, absolutely. It's important to focus on the 80% that one can accomplish with 20% effort, that Pareto principle, which is largely lifestyle, how we interact with the world around us. Being personalized in nature, the Methuselah protocol is able to accomplish a lot more. Part of that is a behavioral psychology approach. So if you're not going to run, we should not be telling you to go running, right? There are many different avenues to the same outcome. As far as things that set us apart, of course, we focus on things and limit ourselves to things that are already proven to be safe and effective in humans. With that said, that allows us to explore and use interventions that are safe and effective, but perhaps are off-label. So for example, the hyperbaric oxygen has benefits for far more diagnoses and symptoms than what conventional medicine, what insurance will cover, what they have deemed is sufficient to cover. In inclusion with that would be treating preconditions. So for example, rather than waiting until someone has active diabetes or active hypertension, treating them in a very careful way to maintain safety, while also making sure that they're safe in the future as well. So there are various prescription medications that we use off-label. There are various natural medications that have the science to support them, as well as a variety of interventions, such as hyperbaric oxygen, as well as those lifestyle aspects.
That's great.
So I'm taking metformin. I'm not diabetic, but I'm taking metformin to make sure that my trajectory doesn't end up with me at diabetes.
Well, you know, David, I want to talk a little bit, not so much about the medical intervention, but maybe a little bit about the fund. You said the fund had been already closed, but, you know, you have some interesting funders, and some of those are the names we all well know at this point, Elon Musk and Peter Thiel. Tell us why they're supportive, and also tell us about the size of the fund and when did you close it and do you expect to open a second round?
So the original funders of the foundation, notably Peter Thiel, really risked their reputations to start something like this, because at the time it was like, what are you talking about? Crazy. But now it's becoming much more conventional, although avant-garde. Recently, that is in 2021, we received a donation, a very large donation of crypto from Vitalik Buterin, the co-founder of the Ethereum crypto system. And that has helped us invest in a number of startup companies. We have not yet decided whether we're going to start another fund. That depends on whether or not the industry, the venture capital industry, carries forward on its own. Our goal is to find holes and fill them, create a path so that others can follow if they think it's a good path, as opposed to getting big. We do not want to get big. We want others to get big so that we can stay light, lean, fast, and furious.
Sure. What are the number of projects you funded right now? Can you give us a sense of size? Sure.
We've probably invested around $20 million in a variety of companies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And those companies themselves typically by now have attracted somewhere around a collective maybe $700 million. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty decent size. And as those companies have come to the attention of other investors, well, then there have been billions that have been invested in other companies by other notable investors like Sam Altman, Jeff Bezos. Thiel continues to invest. And also the Hevolution, which is the Saudi investment fund for longevity, and Mubadala, which is UAE's investment fund. So there's a tremendous amount of light coming into this area.
Well, one way to go big is always if there's a change in national policy or funding support for these initiatives. And we can't help but think, given Elon Musk's apparent closeness to our incoming President Trump, do you anticipate that his administration will be more supportive of longevity? Are there specific areas in which you're advising Elon Musk on these matters as it relates to what the federal government might do to support this work?
One of the nominees is Jim O'Neill, and he was the CEO of the SENS Foundation. And the SENS Foundation was spun out of Methuselah Foundation. So that's the chain of events. Jim O'Neill really understands the value of avoiding the suffering and the disease of the diseases that don't actually have to happen if aging is held back. So he will be, I think, Deputy Secretary of Health and Human Services, if I'm not mistaken, as long as he's, confirmed as a nominee. And he's very much in favor. And if you look at RFK Jr. and the other nominees, they're very much in line with the idea of holding aging back by whatever means. That's my view.
David, I want you to maybe shine a little more light on your ties that you already have to NASA with their vascular tissue challenge and the deep space food challenge. Both sound fascinating. I think our audience would love to hear about them.
Oh, thank you. So our new Parts for People strategy invested in the world's first three-dimensional tissue printing company. Science fiction, but now it's real. And as a result of investing in that company, there's now human on a chip, meaning that you'll be able to test drugs and other biologics in human tissue, and one day not even need to use animals, which I love animals. I don't want to hurt them. So that's one thing. But what we discovered was that once you engineered 20 cells thick out of the printer, it began to die from the inside out. And so that was a result of not having enough capillaries and venules, microvasculature. So in 2013, we proposed to NASA that barrier, that vascularity limit, needed to be broken. 2016, they agreed. And in 2021, it was broken. Wake Forest and W Firm both won first and second place. And so now that limit is gone as a result of a prize. And what was the prize award? $500,000. It's chicken feed. But because it was a partnership with NASA, the NASA's branding and the fact that it's the government sponsoring it brought in tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars worth of effort, and probably took 10 years out of the timeline.
Well, there are a lot of theories about things that can cure us. Danielle, I'm thinking about obesity and the impact that has on longevity. Also thinking about the new interventions of Wegovy and others that are out in the marketplace. What's your sense about their efficacy and the impact that it will have in terms of longevity for people as they obviously are able to control their weight?
Yeah, so the Wegovy, Ozempic, the GIP and GLP, one agonist classes of medications, as well as some that are coming down the pipe likely to hit the markets in about 3 years, are examples of some medications we use off-label to positively manipulate the health landscape of an individual. Of course, this is generalizing. Not everybody would be a good candidate to use those medications, but we do see incredible changes, not just in the research, but also anecdotally with the measures in our patient population, with changes for their weight, changes for their A1C, their average glucose. That's expected. We know that happens with these medications. We also see improvements with their insulin resistance, improvements with their lipids, improvements with their socialization, their engagement with their social and community environment, which is a positive effect we can't ignore, their emotional landscape. We also see new research coming out for these medications that they manipulate some of the pathways that drive aging as well. We see particularly with the GIP medications, tirzepatide, which would be Mounjaro or Zepbound, that they reduce inflammation globally. They also are in the AMPK and SASP pathways, meaning they make your body think that it's calorie restricting when it not necessarily is. We also see some research for addiction, so reducing negative behaviors like alcohol and tobacco use, as well as reduced incidence of autoimmune flares. So there really are a lot of different targets that are very exciting for these medications, some of which are very early in the research, some of which are far enough along for us to be able to incorporate in individual protocols for different people.
Danielle, I think you and David may know that we're very engaged in primary care, community health centers, creating access, and obviously health equity is a huge concern for us here in the United States. And as we move from the research bench to practice and thinking of your practice in Vienna, you know, there's undertones of this would be denied by insurance. This would not be covered. This would not be available to people on public insurance and for people without insurance at all. Far-fetched. Tell me, what are your thoughts as you think about how do you democratize the knowledge that you have? How do you bring that to a public sphere? Because while some of your treatments probably are beyond people's ability to secure if they're not wealthy, other things are within grasp for people with information, motivation, and support. So tell us just a little bit about your view on that.
Absolutely. So making this available to as many people as possible, as many people who want it as possible is very important to us. Everyone deserves to have good health, and that is good for society at large, for people to maintain their health. We were featured in the Wall Street Journal about a year ago in a very clickbaity title, which was that the $100,000 clinic will see you now. And we were featured as an alternative because our cost of healthcare is so much lower. Of course, things will change and the insurance model will change. So currently the insurance business model is spend as little on you as possible per year because they don't know if you're going to continue with them next year. Medicare is a little bit different. They're a little bit more focused on long-term health outcomes. What we want is for that to change and for this to be the matter of course of what healthcare is and be able to deliver this to everyone.
Well, I want to thank both David and Danielle for joining us. It's really been a fascinating conversation. I know our audience is going to stay tuned to the work that you're doing and keep an eye on it. We want to thank our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. As always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. You can also share your thoughts and comments about this program. And we wish everyone best wishes for a happy holiday and happy new year. Thank you both for joining us today.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.